Joining us today on the Dusty Wright Show, guitarist extraordinaire, Mr. Derek Trucks. Today's show is brought to you by our friends at Gibson Guitars. For the finest in American guitars, visit GibsonGuitars.com. Joining us today on the Culture Catch, Mr. Derek Trucks. Now, if you don't know Derek's music, you don't know his vibe, by the end of this interview, hopefully you'll have an appreciation for what this talented individual. We don't want to give away all the family trade secrets, but very honored to have you on the show.
Thanks
I've been
for
chasing
having me.
You for a couple of years now. I bet you didn't even know that.
No, I've been running.
You're always playing. You're always
outside the grass.
Yeah, the problem is you're always on the road with either your project, the Derek Trucks Band, or with brothers, or or the project with your wife, or producing. Or
it's been a busy few years, but it's been good. You know, we're fortunate. It's lucky to be working these days. So too many gigs is a good thing.
And also within your profession. As an old-timer, somebody who grew up with, considered the masters of the form, people always say, oh, can you take the guitar anywhere else? Can you take your instrument or your song craft or your songwriting or your band into a new place, a new domain? And it gets increasingly more and more difficult, but you had an early jump on things because you started as a young, as a small boy.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time now because there's one side of music that's just trying to out-hip itself, and everybody's trying to find new ground. But there's this whole area that seems to be left of people that actually just tap in to the source and play, and learn their instrument and actually do something legit. So there's a huge void. It's real easy to just play good music that you believe in. And I'm noticing the more we circle the globe, there seems to be a great appreciation for that. People that it's not going back and repeating things that are already done. It's just playing honest music. So we're fortunate that a lot of times it's a lot easier than you think it is. If you mean what you say and mean what you play, I think people appreciate that. Even fans that don't have the greatest knowledge of music or the intricate parts of music, they can tell if you mean it. They can tell your intention. So I think we're fortunate that that's where we naturally come from anyways.
Yeah, I think, maybe it's the outcry. We've been so slogged in this digital world where you can auto-tune everything. You don't really have to be a musician. Because we're talking about being an organic musician. You can pick up an acoustic guitar, write a song, play it.
Yeah.
Acoustic, and people can feel that soulful connection.
And just yesterday we did a morning show, and all the union crew, they were just so happy to see a band that didn't have a laptop on stage. They're like, wow, it's an amp and a guitar and a drum set. It's sad when that sets you apart from other people, but that's what we're dealing with.
Yeah, but I think within your circle and your style genre of music, people, I think the circle is expanding. Look, it was very interesting to me when growing up in the 60s and 70s that the blues was a form indigenous to America that got lost in the shuffle. And it took the UK guys and all the guitar heroes from there to reintroduce America.
To make the young people appreciate
them. Yeah, like Muddy Waters and all these guys. Like, why weren't they household names,
A lot of times, people have to, you have to fly the coop. You have to get away from the nest. And sometimes it takes music going halfway around the globe and coming back until you really appreciate what's in your backyard. But, that's just the nature of things. I think it's great that it seems to be happening again in a sense where I'm seeing a lot of young people at our shows the last 2 or 3 years, where for a long time it really was a much older demographic. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see, young kids that sometimes are musicians, sometimes not, but, getting interested in the music that we're doing and music from previous eras. Good to see a 16-year-old with a Sly Stone t-shirt on, I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, talk about your musical influences. You had a very heavy blues influence. I'm sure, your uncle had something to do with it, your father, your family. You were insulated in a world that was completely driven by this blues R&B genre and then really expanded on that footprint in their own style.
Yeah, the music that was in my house growing up, it was, it was those Allman Brothers records, Eat a Peach, Fillmore East, the Derek and the Dominoes record. My mom was listening to Joni Mitchell and a lot of the folk artists from that era, but it was, Elmore James, B.B. King, But, you know, when you hit the road at 9, 10 years old, you're surrounded by musicians, so you're constantly hearing other music. You're hearing, you know, the music that influenced the musicians you're playing with. And I always made it a point to pick their brains. And when you're that age, the competition isn't there yet, so people are really willing to open up to you and show you things. And, you know, I was fortunate for the first 8, 10 years of my career, I was young enough to not be a threat to people. So I got some great advice. And, you know, later on, you go through a different phase where they're like,
can't
they
step
play
out
in
yet.
The corner. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. That's, yeah, that's a very good point. And it's funny because when I saw you early on with the brothers, it was like, he's kind of off in the corner. And you could see the progression that you get a little bit closer to the center, a little bit closer, a little bit closer.
Yeah, I mean, when you join a band that's 10 years older than you are, I mean, the band had been, I think when I joined, it was the 30th anniversary, and I was 20, so it's hard to come in and throw your weight around. you gotta lay low for a few years.
You were in stealth mode.
Pick your spots.
Yeah, yeah. Now talk about the Derek Trucks Band. You've had that band since you were 15?
14, something like that.
So. Yeah.
I mean, we're thousands of shows into it.
It's amazing. And, you know, there's still millions of people that need to know about this band because, you know, obviously you have guys my age that are like, the brothers. But it's such a different experience, the Derek Trucks Band. It's so liberating, I guess, perhaps for you, because you have all these different genres that you work into your music, your shows, into each song.
I mean, it's great having a band where anything that moves you or influences you, you can at least give it a shot, throw it out there. And you got to have musicians that are versatile enough to do those things. And, you know, playing with the Allman Brothers has been great, but it is their legacy and their catalog, and it's nice being in a situation where, you know, the path before you is just wide open. You can do whatever you want. So it's been great. I mean, we've had a great run. We've been incredibly fortunate to be able to play the music we love to play and still have people showing up and enough gas in the bus to get to the next city. So, I wouldn't trade it. It's been a slow build for 16 years, and looking back on it, I don't think I would want it any other way. I mean, it makes you appreciate every step of the way, and it also, it keeps you grounded.
And plus, your fan base is that much more solid. You've grown it organically, and you're accumulating more and more fans, word of mouth.
You see a lot of the same faces, which is nice, and you don't worry about it being fleeting. I mean, I've seen a lot of bands come and go over the 16 years that we've been out, and it's, you know, sometimes taking the long road and doing it the right way is what gets you there in the end.
Absolutely. Your songwriting, this new record, there seems to be, a lot of critics have said, you know, this is the most melodic Derek's sounded since he's formed the band, you know, the most cohesive record in his career. Maybe, you know, some people are saying it's the best record of your career. How do you feel about that?
You know, I was really happy with the way this record came to be. I mean, doing it at home was great, but it really was just having time to do a record, which I never had before. Mm. I mean, we tour so much, and there's been so many great opportunities that have popped up along the way. There's never been 2-3 weeks to just write and lay low, and this record was the first time that happened. And I think for me, being creative and introverted is hard to do when you're on the road. As far as songwriting, I find it a lot easier when you can kind of get out of the grind and just, you know, decompress for a minute. So I think the light bulb went off, and I realized that this is the way we have to do records from here on out. You have to take a deep breath and get away from the road for a minute. And, you know, also being around that Clapton tour and listening to his catalog and all those great tunes and Wynwood and all these guys, you get in that songwriter mode. And when you play these songs with those guys, it kind of gives you a little insight into the writing process. You know, you hear certain chord changes used in certain places often, and there's definitely something to it. And, you know, whether it's listening to the great Beatles tunes or Eric's great tunes, the Dominoes stuff, the Mad Dogs and Englishmen, great songwriting in that form is it's a lot of fun to play over too. So I think once I started appreciating that more, it became a lot easier to do it yourself.
Were you intimidated initially playing with Eric, or when he asked you? I know you did some of his blues, his big blues festival stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that was the very end of the tour, the Crossroads thing.
Right, the Crossroads.
You know, when I got the call, it was so out of the blue that you almost didn't have time to be in awe or starstruck.
Right.
And he was very humble when you're around him. He makes you feel like he wants you there, and he's great that way. But there's definitely when you're on stage and you look over and you're playing Layla or one of these classic tunes that you've heard since you were a child, and you're like, oh shit, that's Eric Clapton over there. there's definitely moments, you know.
And, oh wait, I lost my place.
Yeah, the same with playing in the Allman Brothers the first few years, and that was the music I was weaned on. So you know, you have a healthy respect for it while you're in the thick of it.
Right. Are there any musicians that you respect that you know, in any genre, world beat? There's all these great African guitarists who I just hear and I go, wow.
Yeah.
These guys are playing stuff that's so out. I'm surprised, you know, they haven't really westernized their sound. Or other jazz players or anything?
I mean, there's a ton of them. I'm fortunate that in the circle we run in, you run into almost every touring group.
So. Right.
Guys like Eric Krasno, who plays in the band Soul Live. There's a great guitar player from Madagascar named DeGary, who plays it's such a unique sound.
Right.
Friends like Jimmy Herring and Doyle Bramhall. There's a lot of guitar players that I really learn a lot from. Sometimes it's what they don't play. Sometimes it's the way they comp behind another artist. Sometimes it's the way they write. Sometimes it's tone. Sometimes it's, you know, it's all of those things.
Now, tone, that's an interesting thing. You know, the Clapton tour, the tone you guys have, you're purist. No stomp boxes, nothing, man. You've got your own rig, you know, your own SG. Plug in and go, man. You know, Tom Verlaine used to do that with television, you know. Yorma, when I talked to Yorma, same thing. Maybe a volume pedal, and that was it.
Well, you know, you find that a lot of great artists, their sound is just kind of in their hands, and, you know, the right equipment helps, but I remember listening to those early Howlin' Wolf records and hearing Hubert Sumlin and thinking, you can't get that sound with good equipment. It has to be just a $12 guitar and a beat up amp. And then I saw him a few years ago plugging into a brand new PV amp, and it was like a brand new Les Paul, and I was like, this isn't going to be right. And then he played and it was the exact same sound.
It was, so there you go.
It's just sometimes wow. you're going to find a way to make it sound good. So.
But, you know, Buddy Guy on that record, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're just a classic sound, him and Junior together.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of times I find that simplifying it is the best. Get back to, you know, find a guitar and an amp you like and just, you know, make it happen. A lot gets lost in the chain when there's too many chords and pedals.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Derek, when you write, do you have a favorite guitar you like to compose on?
You know, every instrument is different. I mean, certain instruments force you to play a certain way. So I find when I write, I like picking up whatever guitar is laying around and just and kind of going with that.
Right.
You know, you're going to write differently on an acoustic guitar than you are on an electric guitar. You're going to write differently on a, you know, an old beater Guild than you are a brand new great guitar. So I find much like playing music, you kind of have to go with the flow of things. So. And I like writing on bass or piano, even drums sometimes. It gets you out of your comfort zone.
Right. Makes you think about the structure a little different.
Absolutely. And sometimes you wake up with a song in your head and it takes a while to actually find it. You're messing yourself up. Stop it.
Uh-oh, yeah. Wake up in the middle of the night. I got to get this down.
That's
man.
Right.
Now, obviously there's a comfort zone now with your new studio. And is it biosustainable, solar powered? You're really going green, like Jack Johnson did his studio. And
you know. It's half and half. We put as many panels as we could on the roof, but it definitely makes it. There's less guilt involved for sure. But you know,
and some savings, I hope, in the energy bills.
Yeah, we'll see, right?
Well, that's always the layout, right? For all these green initiatives, there's always that big layout, and they say, well, you know, over time,
you get hit up front, and then you feel good about it. It feels good. It's a good bruise.
Good bruise. I like that. Is there one? Is there a song that you never tire of playing that you've written? Is there a go-to song?
You go through stages with. It's like any relationship, you know. It's. There's great moments. There's times you got to shelve it for a minute.
Don't yell that out in the middle of the show, right?
Yeah, exactly. Not tonight. But you know what? The beauty of playing in multiple bands and playing in a band that that hasn't had a major hit is people don't expect one song every night. So you can get away with, if a song's getting tired, you just put it away for a minute. You know, it's But it really depends on how you approach a song. I find that if you go into to each show with your mind open just enough. You can play, you can repeat a tune and have it be different every night too.
A variation on the theme.
Yeah, but once it gets into a rut, you have to shelve it for a minute.
Yeah. Has there been any surprises for you in playing, like a wow moment, you know, in the last year with this new record?
I mean, there's been a few. You know, we just had a great show in Spain. We played, it was Pontevedra, Spain, and it was an outdoor town square. And, you know, we had never been anywhere close to there. So, you know, you're thinking 8, 10, maybe 40 people, you know, and 5,000 people show up. And it was just a great moment. It was one of the better shows we've had in quite a few years. And there was just a great spontaneous, like, soccer chant for
really?
The encore. And
wow.
Kofi, our keyboard player, plays flute as well. He was playing with the crowd. And then I guess it was a religious holiday that day. So as we're closing out the second encore, there's fireworks going off in the square. It was a great moment. There's one other show that we did Jazz Fest in New Orleans a few years ago. And there was, every once in a while, you get a real legit encore where you're over curfew, show's done, and the crowd's just not having it.
Right.
Like, you will come back.
Right.
There will be another song.
That's so surge, man.
Those are fun.
Yeah.
Know? We do a lot of shows, and every once in a while, you kind of, everything lines up. It's the right crowd. It's the right, everybody slept right or whatever it is. You can't really quantify it.
But yeah.
There's magic.
It. We had this in New York. Michael, our one camera guy here, played with Rise Chatham, who did 200 Guitars, the world premiere at Lincoln Center, where you're playing tonight. And it was one of those magical moments. 200 guitars, man. And it was the ebb and flow, the sound, the whole thing, you know. It was just it's like, you don't know if it'll ever be replicated. Now, he downscaled it because he did 400 guitars in France inside a cathedral.
That was a little much.
Yeah. But, you know, and everyone had their own amp. That was the other
thing.
So it was 200 guitars, 16 basses, and a guy playing the hi-hat to tap, and four conductors with Rise on stage. There's stuff on YouTube. You got to watch it. It's crazy, man.
It sounds like my nightmare, but it could be.
No, it was. It truly was a wonderful experience. You know, and there were guys who played in bands all their lives in New York. I said, "Yeah, man, I want to experience this." And there was
that's
that,
cool.
As you're talking, that communion with the audience. That is.
Was it a written out piece, or was it just free?
It's completely written out.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. And Michael can talk more to the point after the interview, because he's, you know, he was in it last year and they got rained out and they had to come back and do it this year.
Gotcha.
And it was just crazy. You know, you would think, how, you know, you were enveloped in sound, and it was the ebb and flow, and it was ambient, you know, because it's minimalism.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, there was a
texture. You can't have 200 guitars blasting at the same time.
Yeah.
I played in a band with two, and that's or three.
Well, three, right. Yeah, exactly. You can imagine competing for that. What do you read? What do you do to unwind? What's Derek Trucks do to unwind? You get to ever unwind in the last 10 years?
We do a record. That's what we do.
Yeah.
I mean, you do a lot of reading on the road, a lot of listening. I mean, there's three or four of us in the band that we make the most of it. I mean, when you're traveling Europe, every town you're in, you try to get a feel for the place, you know, the food, the wine, the people, whatever town you're in. There might be a great novel written there. You try to get into it. I mean, it definitely enhances the experience. I've been in bands where everybody holes up in their hotel, and I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah, well, come on, see the city.
You can't tell where you are, but it was, like, that Clapton tour was great. We did 22 countries, and you just...
Wow.
It's such a great thing when you can really plug into a city and feel the place. It makes you appreciate things, and it makes you see a lot of common threads. You know, you see that people are... 80% of humanity is after the same thing. You know, it's pretty common. Everybody wants to... have a job, eat well, listen to some music, unwind. Like it's
have
pretty,
a roof over their head.
It's pretty simple, you know.
Absolutely.
I think it's really easy to cloud a lot of issues, but when you get down to it, it's you know, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah, absolutely. And music is the liberating. You know, it's interesting. Music is such a universal thing. It just transcends every language, every barrier.
Definitely. I mean, over the last, I guess, decade of especially touring overseas, you. Almost every interview you do, by the end of the interview, they're going politics, and they want to know, you know, they really start digging in, and every once in a while I have to go, time out. I'm from the land of B.B. King, Willie Nelson, John Coltrane, Ray Charles. Like, that's what we do. That's
right.
Our thing. You
right,
know?
Right, right.
Let's don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Don't get me involved, man.
Yeah, like, we're, you know, we're in we're in Italy and France and Switzerland, and you're doing a blues festival, a jazz festival. I was like, this is our gift to the world. I mean, there's a lot of them, but when you bring certain names up, it kind of calms everybody down. They're like, oh yeah, I like Willie Nelson. I like B.B. King. I like Les Paul. You know? So it's I find that music it can calm things too.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever been in those situations where you've had to use the music to get people in line, keep them in check,
till you got out of town? Every single night. Every single night. I mean, we have a great job. I mean, we get to play music for a living and travel the world. I mean, it could be a lot worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you intimidated by any string instruments? Have you tried, have you picked up the indigenous stringed instruments in Africa, these three string things, the bouzouki, the zither, hammered dulcimer?
I find it all enhances your thing,
Yeah.
I play sarod, an Indian classical instrument, and, it just brings a different side of your playing out. And
right.
I wouldn't say I've mastered any of the stringed instruments, but, it's fun to play a koro or any, the older the instrument gets, I find that you learn more because you get down to the one stringed instrument.
Right.
You're like, wow, it's just a melody. That's all you got.
Right,
let's get down to it.
Right. Yeah. And how about your kids? Where do they recognize, like, wow, Dad's, he's a pretty serious musician. A lot of people really respect his craft and what he's bringing to the world of music.
I don't know if they've gotten that far yet. I mean, they know what we do. And they have great taste for music.
Your wife as well, yeah.
But they have learned. I think they learned sarcasm first. So they're like busting on me. But they're
oh,
great.
Really?
Yeah, they're great though. I mean, they
busted on pop.
That's right.
Oh man, it's only going to get worse. Let me tell you, my kids are older.
Yeah, yeah. I got to get them in line soon. But it's fun, They like we'll make them mix CDs, and I love it. They have such great taste in music.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter, it's Bobby Womack and Billy Preston and Stevie Wonder and Otis Redding, and my son, there's a few Frank Zappa tunes that he can't get enough of. And,
right.
But they love listening to Sam Cooke and a lot of the great soul singers. So
uh-huh.
I appreciate that. That makes a trip to school a lot easier than what their friends want to listen to.
Power 100, whatever it is,
yeah,
man.
Like, when your parents drive, you can listen to that.
Exactly.
not today.
That's funny. Now, you guys are involved in some charities and stuff in Jacksonville, you and Susan. Is that true?
A few, yeah. Susan's done a lot of shows for, it's called the River Keepers. They keep an eye on the St. John's River, which is a mess often. So she's done shows for them and helped out. And I mean, we do what we can on the road. We really try to keep in mind that we are very fortunate and lucky, and you give back when you can. I think it's generally best to leave those things unsaid, because I know far too many people that get more of a personal thrill out of airing out their charity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think if it's if you're doing it to lead people to it, it's a great thing.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's a huge part of what you do. If I think people can hear that in your playing and your mm-hmm. music, if you're on the right team or not.
Well, everyone's we're so celebrity driven. Everyone wants to know everything about Derek or this gal or this person. And man, where are they? Where are they promoting? Where are they standing behind politically and socially? And it's like, how about your own opinion? People are so they want to galvanized behind these pop icons and stuff.
I think it's important as a musician. I think back to somebody like Bob Dylan, who everybody assumes they know his politics, and then you mm-hmm. listen to his tunes and you're like, he never really lays it on the line. He kind of goes for the universal truths and he mm-hmm. goes for great stories. And I think for me, it's more important to give people the tools to make their own decisions, whether it's musically or whatever. Like, you feed them things that are fact and true and things that feel good, and then you hope they fall on the right side of it. Because I think once you get into this preaching mode and you start telling people what to think, you're gonna divide the room, and people are gonna believe what they believe already.
Right.
I think it's a lot easier to kind of go more subtle. I remember right after 9/11, we were playing a lot of like Qawwali tunes, these Pakistani Indian mm-hmm. classical tunes, and I remember the first show we did after 9/11 playing a Qawwali tune, and there was this weird sense in the crowd of like, is this wrong to even play?
Oh, really?
It's music.
And yeah,
then,
yeah.
But then you feel people come around, and it humanizes things. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like, it's that music can't be a bad thing. You know,
no.
Melody can't be a bad thing. And I think it puts a human face on things when you can incorporate different cultures into what you do.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Because politics is politics.
No, and you know, I mean, even with our website, if somebody's political, I can't, and they want to be political in the interview, fine. But, you know, why do I want to turn off somebody else who might otherwise not listen or should listen and experience the art and what the individual
There's a time and place for everything. I do think, you know, when you think about the civil rights movement and all the great music that was made and you know, that got behind a point, and it really gave voice to a lot of things. I think there is a time and place for it, but I think once you start telling people, you run the risk of blowing it up.
Yeah. I don't know. You want to share anything else? Any other passions you're pursuing that we should know about?
No, that's
Inquiring minds want to know.
I got nothing else. That's it.
Derek, I wonder if we can get you to play one acoustic song, solo. Do you feel like anything?
You know, I guess I could.
I want to show you this fine guitar. I'm actually thinking of, I'm not going to tell you whose model this is because we don't want to pimp for them, but look at
pimp.
This. Now, it's the Elvis Costello model.
That's a beautiful guitar.
And I'm trying to get them to give me this guitar, man. Come on, Gibson.
If you pimp it.
Yeah, I'm pimping their guitar online, man.
I'm not going to do a full song, but we'll...
Nah, please just, you know, have some fun, man. I meant to ask you while you're doing that. You play in a lot of open tunings, because I'm a guitarist as well. What got you into the open tuning modalities?
You know, I think I was maybe 10 or 11 and somebody showed me...
Open D or...
Open E.
Open E.
Just all the things I've been hearing on record just made so much more sense, so...
And it just... Do you ever write in just conventional tuning?
Just rarely.
Rare.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's his name is the same way from King Crimson, Robert Fripp. He has his own tuning scales. I had a friend who studied with him, and you have to get into his whole modality.
You know, and Joni Mitchell did that a lot.
Right, absolutely.
She doesn't even remember which tuning she wrote. So,
oh, really?
So, yeah.
Oh, she wrote her own. Yeah, I love those kind of tunings. I appreciate you playing a little thing. I think this is it's like a Blues King body.
Yeah, I have an old Kalamazoo that feels like this.
Oh, you do?
This. Yeah.
Yeah, these, you know, and this is to your point about the old, you know, the old school. Now, you know, you're playing Merle Travis style, which is a hard-ass style to play. I've never been able, or is it a modified Merle Travis?
You know, it's a bastardized version.
It is hard, and you know, if you're watching, learning how to finger, not use a pick, and use your thumb, your forefinger, and your middle finger, right?
I do. And you know, he's one of the unsung heroes.
Merle? Yeah, Merle Travis, get those records. They will blow your mind.
He could play, man.
Yeah. Well, so can you. Derek, Les Paul passed away, and we happened to be at Gibson Guitars. Gibson, you know, he was the guy. You play an SG.
Yeah.
You play Gibson. What's your memories of Les Paul, his contributions to the music?
I mean, you know, it's amazing. I mean, he's like a combination of Tom Dowd and Leo Fender and Charlie Christian. I mean, he's a great player. He was an inventor and just a really sweet guy. I mean, I was fortunate enough to share the stage with him a handful of times, a few times at the Iridium. Actually, my son was 6 months old. My wife was sitting in with Les Paul, holding him, and I was playing, and it was a great moment. And then we did his 90th birthday with him, did an instrumental version of Goodnight Irene, and hearing him tell stories about Mary Ford and just a total character. It struck me today when I heard, when there's so many artists, when they go down, you look over their life and it just seems like such a tragic, weird ending. And I love the fact that he was 94 and he was just a completely enjoying his life to the very end. It's a great story. I mean, he really, I bet he didn't have many regrets if he had any, you know.
Absolutely.
I was like, that's the way to go out, you know, just doing your thing. He got to that point where it seemed, I don't know, maybe somewhere in his 80s, he's like, I'm going to say whatever I want.
Right.
I'm Les Paul.
Right, exactly.
He would tell the most off-color jokes. I loved his whole vibe. But yeah, I mean, it's a big loss, but that's the way you live a life.
Full and rich.
That's right, man. I mean, he could take any one of the many things he did, and it would be enough for most people, you know, inventing multi-tracking and then the first great solid body electric guitar. And I mean, the amount of things he pulled off is pretty astounding. And then, you know, just as a player, I mean, he's just an amazing mind. And the last time I saw him, I think he was probably 92 and just sharp as a tack.
I mean,
his body was giving out on him, but he was, his brain was not diminishing at all. So that's, you know, see so many tragic stories of musicians ODing and just getting weird, and then you see somebody like Les Paul, you're like, that's what I'll shoot for.
That's an inspiration.
I want to be 94 and just cracking jokes on stage and enjoying it. So
right. All right, Derek, thanks so much again.
Beautiful.
Look for you down the road, next gigs, and whatever else you may be recording or
sounds good
pontificating about musically.
We will be around. Right. We will be around.
Dusty Wright, Derek Trucks, and we'll see you guys soon.
All right.
I'd like to thank my guest, Mr. Derek Trucks, and of course, my always trustworthy audio engineer, Stavros. This is Dusty Wright for The Dusty Wright Show. If you enjoyed this interview, please leave your comments in the iTunes directory. And please, by all means, visit culturecatch.com for all of your smart culture needs. Converge is the word.